Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Perhaps the most enduring image of an American hero that has, I would say probably permanently, entered the American psyche, and that is of the policeman and the firefighter, the paramedic, all standing there and being called to action in the face of terrorism. September 11th showed us these men at work climbing stairs of a building that they probably knew better than others was doomed to destruction. And yet they climbed the stairs anyway. We have honored them as a nation. We have honored them in public ceremonies. We've honored them privately. And that's all good. That is all very good. There was something going on September 11th that perhaps we didn't take note of, and that was maybe the beginnings of the first cracks in a feminist ideology that says that men and women are completely indistinguishable from one another, that what a man can do, a woman can do, and what a man can do, a woman does. And maybe September 11th has given a bit of a lie to that presupposition of feminism. We'll talk about that in the first few minutes of this hour with Phyllis Schlafly. If you'd like to join us, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're also experiencing it now as we watch our service people continuing the effort in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. That'll also enter our conversation. Phyllis Schlafly is president of Eagle Forum, author of the book Feminist, Fantasies, and a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Phyllis, welcome back.
Hello, Todd. Good to join you.
You say that feminism and terrorism met face-to-face 2 years ago this last week. What do you mean by that?
Well, all of a sudden we needed some big, strong men, didn't we? We found that the firefighters went up the World Trade Towers trying to save people, and there weren't any women firefighters going up. They were all men. When they tallied up the death toll, it was, I think, 343 firefighters, men, who were killed. No women, because they couldn't carry the ladders, the hoses, whatever else the firemen carry up those stairs. It is a real man's job. And then, of course, when President Bush sent out the men to Afghanistan to go through the caves and find the bad guys, we noticed they were all men. I'm just so happy we have big, strong men who are willing to go protect us from the bad guys of the world.
It seems as though, you know, to me, being the dinosaur, the old fuddy-duddy I am, this is common sense. When there is a dirty, dangerous, and grueling job that needs to be done, the men go do it. Is there some wisdom to this common sense?
Well, it's perfectly obvious that men are considerably stronger, bigger, heavier than women. And there are some jobs that men do better than women. Men are the risk takers. They are willing to go out and fight with the bad guys of the world. And I thank them for it. The feminist ideology for years has been to try to convert us into a gender-neutral or androgynous society and to pretend there aren't the differences that we know are there. They're not going to succeed in making us equal because we're not equal. The men simply are taller, heavier, stronger, more able to fight the bad guys. I noticed when they interviewed one of our Marines over there in Afghanistan when they were looking through those caves, and he was saying, "There's no place I'd rather be than here." And I thank him for it. We just appreciate that. And we need the men to protect us. The feminists have been trying to put women in military combat for years. And just to show you what the difference is between the feminist view and what I would call the traditional common sense view, you remember when that maintenance crew took a wrong turn and got ambushed? An army woman named Shoshana, I think was her name, had a single mother of a 2-year-old, and she was taken prisoner of war. One named Laurie from Arizona was killed. She was a single mother of a 3- and 4-year-old. Now, I look at that, and I say this is an embarrassment for our country. There was no threat we faced that required us to send mothers of infants out to fight the Iraqis. And yet the feminists look at those same facts, and they say, this is great. This is career opportunity for women. This is breaking through the glass ceiling. This is This is showing that women can do anything men can do. And I think it's a different worldview, and I think it's lacking in common sense and compassion and respect for women and all those good things.
How has, with the public policy of the last two decades or so, especially when it comes to our military policy, what effect has feminism had on the strength of our military?
I think it has considerably weakened by feminizing the military. In the first place, it's a career killer for a man to say anything about it. There are double standards in the training. We know that the women do not perform the same as men. Sometimes they grade them on effort rather than on performance, give a woman an A for the same performance that a man would get a C for, and if a man comments on it, that's a career killer. And that is very destructive to morale. It's making the men lie about what's going on, and that just destroys honor and integrity.
In addition to that, I think about the actual battlefield conditions. And I have a younger brother who is now deployed to Iraq. He has a position of command over there in the Sunni Triangle. And I think about the decisions he has to take every day as he hands out orders that may well put women under his command in danger. Now, I don't know his mind on this, but if I were in his shoes, I would be very hesitant to send young women, we're talking about 18, 19, 20 years old, out where men ought to be standing in danger's way.
Oh, that's right. And you'll find men will have different views on that. Some will be very protective of the women. Some will get to be very resentful when the women are getting special privileges or are being paid in the same as the men, but the men are having to carry the loads. You know, the temperature over there is around 115 degrees, and they're required to carry these very heavy loads, 100, 150 pounds. And the women cannot do the same work as the men. And to pretend that they are means that there are men who are picking up the load. And you can see that that breeds resentment. It can't help but do that.
What falsehoods have feminists played to, exploited, in order to support the notion of women serving in combat?
How they exploited that notion?
Yes, what sort of falsehoods have they exploited in order to support women serving in combat?
Well, they got Congress to set up a lobbying group called DACOWITS, Defense Advisory Commission on Women in the Services, paid for by the taxpayers, loaded up with feminists. And then they go around and intimidate the Army brass and demand that women be put in the combat and combat-related jobs. Now, you know, prior to the Clinton administration, even though women were in a lot of risky jobs, they were not supposed to be assigned to areas where they had an inherent risk of capture. But the feminists in the Clinton administration abolished that rule, and that's why those women that I mentioned earlier, Shoshana and Laurie, were in an area where they had an inherent risk of capture. And this is not good for our combat readiness. It's not good for the effectiveness of the armed forces. It's not good for morale. And I think it's an embarrassment to our country.
We've talked a bit about the ground forces. One of the biggest problems that the U.S. Navy has had to face, especially large deployments on aircraft carriers, sometimes 5,000 seamen are out there on these huge floating airports, and many of them are women, there are a lot of young women going home pregnant.
Well, you have to realize that all those young men and women are around 18 to 25 years old at the peak of their raging hormones. They're hundreds or thousands of miles away from home. They're lonely. The work is strenuous and difficult, and they're lonesome. And surprise, surprise, some of them get pregnant. I mean, how is anybody surprised at this? That's what happens. And the Army has placed no restrictions on sex outside of marriage. The benefits for illegitimacy on the part of the women are really very great. If she wants to get out of this service and get home, that's the way she can do it. Get pregnant, and then she has to come home. Then she gets time off for the baby and then daycare. this is one of the things that's happened in the military, is extraordinary benefits and, I would say, inducements to illegitimacy.
Phyllis Schlafly is our guest. We're talking about feminism and terrorism. She's president of Eagle Forum. Her latest book, Feminist Fantasies, is available by calling Spence Publishing. Here's their toll-free number, 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. Or you can visit them online, Spence Publishing, that is, SpencePublishing.com. All one word, SpencePublishing.com. The book is called Feminist Fantasies by Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis, you mentioned the military putting no restriction on sex outside of marriage among those who serve. And I'm thinking about the recent cases of rape, and now they're not quite sure it was actual bona fide rape at military academies where young people are training to be officers in the military. Your thoughts on this?
You notice one of the changes that they made after all this unpleasant publicity was in the press was that they decided to get rid of the co-ed dorms. Now, I don't know where these people come from, that you think they can put boys and girls age 18 to 22 together in the same dormitory and not have things happen. And they never should have had co-ed dorms in the first place. And I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for a girl if she has six drinks and then goes to a boy's bedroom, that's what was going on. They didn't enforce the rules against sex. They didn't enforce any rules against drinking. And I think it's probably there's a little bit of blame to go on everybody in that situation. But I think it's really most unfortunate and really unfair to prosecute those cadets for rape.
The subject that's always raised when it comes to women in combat is the Israeli army. There is this story often told that the Israeli army is entirely sexually integrated and that the women there serve at the same level as the men who serve there under compulsory military service in Israel. Is this all true?
It's one of the biggest lies that's ever been put over on the American people. As one of the Israeli officers said, we don't do foolish things like you do in feminizing the American military because we have to take war seriously. There are all kinds of differences. The women absolutely do not serve in Israeli combat. They serve only half as long. Really, they're treated very much like the WACs and the WAVES were during World War II, which is an entirely different service with different assignments. And I think one of these women said in a newspaper recently, yes, they give us all this training, and then we serve coffee for the officers.
A proper place for women in the American military?
How would you describe that? There is a place. There are a lot of jobs that women can do and do very well. But it should be a separate track, like we had with the WACs and WAVES, where there is a clear basic understanding that women do not have the physical strength of men, and they should not be indiscriminately assigned to all positions. But the feminist movement is working very hard to get women assigned to every combat job, including ground combat, submarines, Navy SEALs, you know, name it, all the rest. And that can do nothing but diminish the combat readiness. It is not good for men or women or the country. And all of the surveys that have been taken by the enlisted women say that they do not want to be treated the same as men. The push is coming from the feminist organizations, the ones who don't like the military in the first place and will never serve, plus some of the officers who already have nice senior desk jobs and will never have to do the grubby work out in the field.
And why do you think that it's one thing to talk about the civilian leadership of the military capitulating to these cultural forces like feminism. Why do you think the actual military leadership capitulate?
Because I think the feminists are very intimidating to them. And it's not normal for men to fight women. And the women lay a guilt trip on the men and basically intimidate them. And that's why I wrote my book, Feminist Fantasies, to help men and women understand what the feminists are all about, how they are waging a destructive assault on our culture, on marriage, on motherhood, on traditional morals, on the military, and how they are able to put out their propaganda through the media constantly, unremittingly, on the national television all the time. And the men need to understand what's going on. And the officers, the senior officers, need to have the civilians in authority, like President Bush, stand up and say, we're not going to put women in combat. That's not what America's all about. We're not going to send mothers out to war, whether they're single mothers or whether they're mothers whose husbands are also serving. You know, the military won't tell us how many mothers are serving over there in Iraq. They claim they don't know. That's ridiculous. Of course they know.
Now, I wonder if this is reversible. I wonder if it has gone too far, that the military has been used as a laboratory for the gender-neutral advocates, whether or not it can be reversed, not only in the culture, but in the military. What do you think?
Well, I think it can be reversed in the military because it's all a matter of regulation. The Marines have never gone in for this co-ed basic training, and the Army and the Navy do have co-ed basic training. They could reverse it. The President could reverse it with a stroke of a pen. This rule about keeping women out of areas where they have an inherent risk of capture, that rule was rescinded with a stroke of a pen by the feminists in the Clinton Pentagon. It could be put back into force by a stroke of George Bush's pen. And I think we have to make our political civilian leaders understand that we want them to respect a gender difference in the military. There should be different roles for men and women. There are good jobs that women can do in the military, but fighting in combat is not one of them.
It seems as though when push comes to shove, and that's kind of where we began our conversation, Phyllis, when push comes to shove, be it in combat or combating terrorism or responding to terrorist attacks here on our own soil, then the men and the women are separated from one another. Then the men do go do that work, and the women, because they lack the same kind of strength of capability, do not do that kind of work. Do you think war, the reality of war that we're experiencing now, will tend to also change the public mindset? Someone says, look, just as a matter of common sense, I'd rather have the boys out there doing the fighting and let the women stay safely at home.
Well, I hope so. And it's a matter of the regulations that Congress and the civilians in the Pentagon can set. And I think we need to keep up the talk and the argument so that people understand what the feminist movement is all about, how it's based on the false ideology that men and women are equal, and that it's somehow oppressive of women not to send them out to fight just like men. That's not oppression of women. That's respect for women and mothers and marriage and traditional values, and we need to restore that. And it can be done. We just have to keep reminding them all the time. And I hope that my new book, Feminist Fantasies, can play a role in that. Your listeners can get a good deal. I think this publisher is offering a 50% discount. If you'll call toll-free at 888-773-6782. That's 888-773-6782.
And that's...
That spells 888... Spen Pub,
S-P-E-N-P-U-B, or the website for Spence Publishing, of course, is SpencePublishing.com. SpencePublishing.com. The book is called Feminist Fantasies. With only a few minutes left here, this, of course, is all part of a bigger conversation that we've had before, Phyllis, and that you continue to talk about not only in your book but elsewhere, the effort of radical feminists to create a gender-neutral society. With the few minutes left to us, that is about two or three. Make your case that this is genuinely what the feminists are all about.
The feminists have not changed their ideology. They want to deprive us of our right ever to make differences of treatment between men and women. And it's based on this false ideology that American women are victims. The truth is, they're the most fortunate class of people who ever lived. And don't think that feminism has died out. You've got a very prominent feminist in the U.S. Senate, Hillary Clinton. You have a very extreme feminist on the U.S. Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is what they believe. They believe that we should have abortion on demand, that the taxpayers should pay for abortions. They endorse the whole gay rights agenda. They are for this senseless androgyny, sameness of treatment of men and women, and they need to be exposed for how they are out of touch with common sense, with traditional moral values, and with reality.
What will we as a nation face, Phyllis, if the agenda to push a gender-neutral society, even within the military and the other areas where people serve in dangerous positions, what will we face as a nation if that is successful?
Well, I think it's very demasculinizing to the men, because the men are very much intimidated by this. And I'm trying to, and I hope that the men will stand up and be men. We want men to realize that one of their duties is to protect women from the bad guys of the world. And yes, we do want that. And we don't want the feminists to be able to take that away from the relationships between men and women. I think the feminists have had a very bad effect on young men and young women who don't understand that God made us of two different kinds. Men and women are complementary to each other. Husbands and wives are complementary. We need the union of a man and a woman to make a marriage. Children need a mother and a father. They don't need two sex-neutral parents. And the feminist ideology permeates so much of our society. It's time for the American people to wake up and resist it, and that's why I hope my book, Feminist Fantasies, will play a role in that revival.
The book is called Feminist Fantasies by Phyllis Schlafly, our guest. You can get it online at SpencePublishing.com. That's SpencePublishing.com, or call toll-free 1-888-SPEN-PUB, 1-888-773-6782. Phyllis Schlafly, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Phyllis Schlafly is president of Eagle Forum and author of that book, Feminist Fantasies. Now, I say it seems like common sense to me, because it does. It seems like common sense. I have a wife and I have a daughter. I also have a son. There is no denying, as a parent of both, that there are differences. There's no denying, as a parent of both, that those differences serve a good purpose. One of the good purposes I think they, by design, by God's design, serve in a civil society is that men who have been equipped physically and in other ways to do the dirty work to protect, if necessary to fight, do that. And we thank all of them who have done it, who've given their lives, and who do that on an ongoing basis. And women who have been equipped by women to do other things can, like the rest of us who are not called upon to fight or protect, benefit from that. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think it's the best for everybody. We'll be right back to talk about the Elizabeth Smart case.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology. The latest issue also contains articles titled The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart by Pastor Eric Rotman, Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay From Evangelicalism to the Evangel. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Pornography is the scourge of the information age. The Internet makes hardcore sleaze as available as weather forecasts. A click can take you, your spouse, or your kids into smut not even imagined 10 years ago. Now a way to fight back. Pornography Awareness Week. Terry Phillips reports.
It took only one invitation, and more than 150 organizations and individuals put their names on a petition to President Bush to use his bully pulpit in a fight against filth.
If he does that, the primary focus of the release will deal with the adult obscenity problem.
Robert Peters' group, Morality and Media, is taking the lead by organizing National Awareness of Pornography Week.
The greatest harm that pornography does is to family life. Pornography damages and very often destroys a marriage.
Michael McManus of Marriage Savers says one half of America's horrific divorce rate has a tie to pornography.
That is a stunning number to me. You know, whether that's the core issue or not, the man becomes sexually aroused only by the pornography.
Which means that while the media dwells on the scandalous effects of porn, rape, or homosexuality in the clergy, it's often your good old upstanding family man that gets hooked.
And if he genuinely becomes consumed with pornography, which a significant number of men do, how can there be anything left over for the wife?
Even some pastors are into it.
If it's a problem from then, think what it is for just average men.
Pornography Awareness Week is the last week of October. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Many porn fighters blame governments of the past, including the attorneys general and the FBI, for not taking pornography and obscenity as a major crime problem. Apparently some do. Among the signers to the letter are a number of FBI agents. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO has a great opportunity for you to become an AM 850 KFUO day sponsor. As a day sponsor, you'll be supporting the ministry of AM 850 KFUO. You'll also receive 5 messages throughout our broadcast day recognizing you as a day sponsor. For more information or to become a day sponsor, call Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438.
What does it mean that every believer is perfect in Christ? You can find out with the new Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this commentary at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to spend the remainder of this second hour of Issues Etc. talking about a case that made the news and will, I imagine, probably come back into the news as well, the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart. Now, you probably are familiar with the story, but if you're not, let me refresh your memory. Elizabeth Smart, a 14-year-old girl, was abducted from her home. It took months for people to ascertain her whereabouts, and when she was found, the story appeared to be even more bizarre than anyone could have imagined. She was found in the custody of a man calling himself Emmanuel. He was apparently a kind of a crafter of his own religion, believed himself to be a prophet from God, believed to have direct revelation from God. He had a wife traveling with him, and Elizabeth Smart, this 14-year-old girl, had also become his wife. They were seen out and about, Elizabeth always with a veil and the other wife always with a veil hiding her face. When she was returned, she appeared to be disoriented, confused, and some have said brainwashed. Now, Elizabeth Smart was a practicing Mormon. The man who abducted her also could probably trace his religion to some form of Mormonism. The question is Mormonism to blame for both the kidnapping and the forced polygamy in which Elizabeth Smart was required to take part in during the time of her abduction? We'll find out as we talk with John Moorhead, Associate Director of the California Office of Watchman Fellowship. If you'd like to join us here in this conversation, our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. John Moorhead is also author of a story In the recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Slim Link Between Mormonism and Notorious Kidnapping. John, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
We've reviewed the story here of Elizabeth Smart and her abductor. Tell us a bit about this man who calls himself Emmanuel.
Emmanuel is a name that was applied by the individual to himself. His real name is Brian David Mitchell. And he was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known popularly as the Mormon Church, for some time, as was his wife, Wanda Barzee. They were excommunicated by the LDS Church for various practices that were, in the words of the LDS Church, far afield from what was acceptable within the church. Now, they have not disclosed what those practices were, simply that he was no longer permitted to be a member of the church. So he was raised within this general Mormon theological system. And then over time, after leaving the group, it appears as if he continued to hold on to some of the basic ideas, such as the notion of continuing modern-day revelation through a spokesperson or a prophet. In fact, he viewed himself in some sense as a prophet and as an individual called by God to restore the LDS Church that he felt was in apostasy because of a rejection of some of its earlier teachings. So he really developed within his own mind and thinking over time an aberrant form of Mormon thinking.
What can we ascertain from his statements, perhaps writings of his, regarding his beliefs and how they differ substantively from kind of the mainstream of beliefs in the LDS Church?
Well, one of the things that authorities discovered in his possession after his arrest and the arrest of his wife was a book that he had written called The Book of Emmanuel David Isaiah, which was an extended name that he applied to himself. And as you read through this religious manifesto, it reads as if Jesus Christ is speaking through him. He is the spokesperson. He is writing this down. He is receiving modern-day revelation in his mind. And as you read through this religious manifesto, you see some anger on the part of this individual at the LDS Church for one thing, rejecting the poor in their midst. For example, Mr. Mitchell and his wife were living on the street. They were destitute financially, so that might factor into some of his perspectives in his writing. But I think that the biggest issue that comes forward is in his mind, and this is where you have a common element between himself and what might be called Mormon fundamentalists, is that the LDS Church is in a state of apostasy, at least in part, because it no longer practices polygamy. So he believes that he was called to restore true Mormon teaching in the LDS Church, at least in part, by picking up once again the practice of polygamy.
So there is a connection, at least in that respect, between the religion being practiced, kind of the homemade religion being practiced by Brian Mitchell, and that of Mormon fundamentalism. Does the LDS Church recognize the legitimacy of Mormon fundamentalism and their call for a return to polygamy?
No, they don't. This has been one of the sticking points. After the LDS Church issued something called the Manifesto in 1890, which was their official declaration that they were no longer practicing polygamy, after some disagreements with the United States government at that point in their history, the LDS Church officially renounced the practice of polygamy. And since that time, a number of groups have come about that are called Mormon fundamentalists. Now, the LDS Church does not care for the term because in their thinking, if you're a Mormon, you're a true Mormon, and you would not hold to the practice of polygamy. You would accept only the official teachings of the church at any given time. So in their thinking, the Mormon fundamentalists, so-called, are apostates and not really Mormons. On the other hand, the Mormon fundamentalists would look at the LDS Church and hold that they are in apostasy. So we do have some similarity between the teachings and practices of Brian David Mitchell and something that goes on in Mormon fundamentalism, namely the practice of polygamy. However, we need to point out that Brian David Mitchell was never a part of any fundamentalist Mormon community.
Have there been any responses officially from the LDS Church as to any link between Brian Mitchell, his religion, his actions, and their teachings?
The only official statements, there have been few statements. Obviously, the LDS Church is extremely public relations savvy and aware. And when this came out, they have constantly over the years had a problem with the community and in their public image over the practice of polygamy and other issues. So they were quick to come out and release a statement. But their statement simply said that this gentleman and his wife were excommunicated from the church and that no proper connection can be made to his practices and the kidnapping and the official teachings of the LDS Church. So they have said a little bit, but not too much, and as an effort to try and distance themselves from some of the more sensational aspects of the story.
Now, I want to be careful here, as I'm sure you do as well, not to implicate Elizabeth Smart, the abductee in this case, as being somehow cooperative. I think it's pretty clear that as a 14-year-old girl, she was abducted and there was a crime committed here, no matter how she, what state she was found in when she was found. But do you believe there's any link between the fact that she is a devout and practicing Mormon and the ability of Brian Mitchell to bring her into this strange world in which he lives?
Well, a number of theories have been put out to try and explain this situation. The peculiar thing about it, of course, as everyone knows, is that once she was discovered, initially when she was kidnapped, she was tied to a tree and buried in a hole and covered over with a board. But after that time, she was seen many times by people in public with Mitchell and Barzee. In fact, at times she was separated from them for periods, and she could have passed quietly or made noise and let people know that she was, in fact, the person that the authorities were looking for, and she never did it. So we're trying to explain the strange behavior. Why was she in public, and yet she never called out and asked for help? She had to be discovered. So a number of theories have been put forward, and one of those is that perhaps through some kind of general shared religious worldview, that perhaps that played a part in it. At this point, I don't think we have enough information from what has been released by the authorities to make that kind of connection.
Someone who says, look, this all just kind of has the same smell to it for me. I see a person who has, even though he's excommunicated from the LDS Church, basically playing off of the general worldview of Mormonism, and especially playing to former practices of polygamy among Mormons, which are undeniable. I see a young girl who's also living in the mainstream of that worldview. I see these two brought together by criminal circumstances, but I see the result being rather unsurprising. How would you respond?
Well, I would respond differently than I think many folks have. If you look at some things that have been presented in the secular media and a few things that Christian apologetics ministries have put forward, there was an immediate connection that somehow Mormonism or perhaps Mormon fundamentalism was directly responsible for this view of polygamy and for the kidnapping and so on, kind of a guilt by association type of thing. I think we need to be very careful. We have very little information that has been released to the public, and everyone is speculating and offering their theories based upon the same set of data. And we have to look at that very carefully and interpret it correctly. So we have conflicting data that's been put forward. For example, some statements have come forward and said from Mr. Mitchell that he kidnapped her because he wanted to have a spiritual sister. In other statements that have been released, he was looking for her as a spiritual wife, as a process of polygamy. So we have conflicting statements coming out as to how he viewed her and what the purpose was for the abduction. So I think we have to be very careful. Oftentimes, unfortunately, I think evangelicals don't have the best track record in terms of how we understand and describe and look at the actions of certain new religious movements or groups that we would call cults. And I think we have to be very careful in how we interpret the limited and conflicting data we have about the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping case.
So at this point, with what we do know, you would consider it to be unfair and unsubstantiated to draw a link between Elizabeth Smart's Mormonism, the connection, the tenuous connection between Brian Mitchell and the LDS Church, and say, look, this is all because they were Mormons.
I believe at this point that is the case. Now, that does not mean that when this case goes to trial, if more information is released, official information to the media and various scholars and others who specialize in religious studies and in comparative religion and so on look at this and try and understand the situation, that more information might not come to light that might lead us to that conclusion. All I'm saying is at this point, with the limited and conflicting information we have, I think it's improper to make a connection between the kidnapping and Mormonism or Mormon fundamentalism.
Now, let's go to some broader issues then here. Mormonism, at least according to the avowed account of its origins, is a repristination movement. I mean, part and parcel of Mormonism is, and I think it is still today, Joseph Smith's contention that all of Christendom is apostate and that there needed to be a restoration or a repristination of the true faith of Jesus Christ. Does it surprise you that Mormon fundamentalism and even people so far afield as Brian Mitchell take up the cause of repristination and of purification?
Not really. It really makes sense if you understand what Joseph Smith Jr. and Mormonism has put forward, the notion that Christianity somewhere after the death of the apostles quickly fell into complete and total apostasy, and it was necessary for God to so allegedly restore the church through Joseph Smith Jr. So therefore, Mormonism considers itself the unique restoration of authentic and true Christianity. So Mormonism can be understood as something of a restorationist movement. So it might be natural to look at the history of Mormonism. You'll see a number of individuals who have come forward, and we have a number of splinter groups that have broken away from Mormonism, many that continue today. And they believe that the LDS Church based in Salt Lake City is, in fact, an apostasy, and they are the true restoration of the Church of the Restoration. So really to see this aberrant type of thing that we see in Brian David Mitchell is not surprising when we look at the history of the movement of Mormonism.
We're talking about Mormonism and the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart. John Moorhead is our guest. He's Associate Director of the California Office of Watchman Fellowship and author of a story in the most recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Slim Link Between Mormons and Notorious Kidnapping. If you'd like to join us, our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Kurt is on the line. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. I think it's unfair even to bring up the connection, and I'll tell you why. Because Paul Hill, who murdered the abortionist, he was excommunicated by the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and no one's running around trying to draw a connection between Orthodox Presbyterians and killing abortionists. But I think the more interesting question is these folks who were very strange and dressed very strangely, they evidently were living in some sort of an Indian tent, and I'm not an expert on the subject, but as I understand, a half mile from the Smart residence. And I do think Utah is a little unique, let's say strange, because I know if there was a kidnapping, a high profile kidnapping in my community, and there were homeless people living in an Indian tent around town, I would think the police would stop by to see who they were. And that was just my comment.
All right. Thank you, Kurt, for that question and that comment. What about his contention, the caller's contention, that it's unfair to even raise the connection? And he makes the analogy with the Paul Hill case.
Well, I think it's an interesting question that he raises. I want to agree on one hand and disagree on the other. The only reason we're not making necessarily any connection. We're simply looking at similarities in terms of the worldview. So we see a general shared Mormon worldview, certainly not the same thing. Elizabeth Smart was an Orthodox Mormon, and her captors had some kind of aberrational form of Mormonism. So there is some kind of general similarity, but not necessarily any connection. So on the one hand, I would recognize the problems there. But on the other hand, I think he does raise a valid point. It's interesting that evangelicals are quick to raise connections between various crimes, whether it's 9/11 and Islam or Mormonism and this kidnapping. And yet whenever self-professing evangelicals, such as the gentleman who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, or other events, we don't make that kind of connection to Christianity. So it is an interesting question that he raises.
And what about his observation about what would be the strange environment in Utah where people, abductors with this 14-year-old girl, could go unnoticed when there was kind of an all-points manhunt for a long time for Elizabeth Smart?
Well, I can't speak for the authorities. I don't know that much about what the average thinking is on the part of the authorities or the average person in the area where she was abducted, or Salt Lake City or Sandy, Utah, and so on. I know, for example, in California, I think we tend to take for granted the homeless, and we tend to look the other way, whether purposefully or simply accidentally, when we see those who are less fortunate, because it's easy to pretend they aren't there. If I were to try and guess, my assumption would be that they simply didn't think that they were credible suspects in terms of homeless people who had some kind of aberrational and strange religious views that included the way they happened to dress and live.
Now, back to a line of questioning that I was pursuing before Kurt called us with his question. There is another aspect to Mormonism that I find it's foundational, it seems, and that is one you've mentioned before, this idea of ongoing revelation. The Mormon Church, in its mainstream, has certainly claimed this authority for itself, and I think it still does, in the person of Gordon Hinckley, ongoing revelation, direct revelation from God. Does it surprise you that someone like Brian Mitchell would decide to claim that for himself?
Not necessarily. It doesn't surprise me. The official position of the LDS Church is that there is an open process of revelation, theoretically an open canon. Even though the Mormons do not add to their four standard works of sacred scripture, nevertheless, they believe that God speaks directly through their president and prophet of the church. However, what they say is, even though an individual Mormon may have some kind of general guidance from the Lord, nevertheless, official and canonical material only comes directly through the president and prophet himself. So they're trying to safeguard the concept of having an open process of revelation, and at the same time not open up the floodgates for every member of the Mormon church or various splinter groups to claim that God is somehow speaking for them. Nevertheless, as I mentioned earlier, within this restorationist idea that Mormonism would fall into, you do have the idea that's out there that God can and does continue to speak through average individuals, even in a process of special revelation. So in a sense, it's not surprising to find somebody who was a part of that general background to come aboard and say that God was speaking directly through him.
Even if there is no connection, and I tend to agree with you, at this point it's unfair to draw any explicit connection unless we know more, but even if there is no connection between the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart and the teachings of the LDS Church, do you think this would still afford the opportunity for the average Mormon, who may not be entirely up on his own history, to question what it is his church does teach?
I'm always encouraging Mormons to take a look at the history of their church in terms of its teachings and practices. Many converts to Mormonism come from a Protestant background, and therefore when they look at the unique teachings such as polygamy and the idea that human beings can become gods themselves, that ought to set off alarms for them. However, on the other hand, we ought to also remember that most people don't join the Mormon church because of certain aspects of their history or doctrine. They're joining for some kind of social system that they feel a part of and that they find inviting. So I would hope that something like this would cause Mormons to reassess their history and their doctrine, but I think given human nature and what tends to attract people to spirituality and religion, they will largely not make that connection.
There has been you mentioned before the LDS Church being very PR savvy. There has been an effort afoot for at least two decades to mainstream the LDS Church in the common thinking of the American citizen, that the LDS Church is just another Christian church. They have adopted kind of this persona in the public square. Can the LDS Church ever escape its roots? Not only if there are people popping up like this, but and Mormon fundamentalists, can they ever really escape their roots and gain that respectability they seem to want so much in the American mind?
I think it's going to be very difficult for Mormons to gain the widespread respectability they want. I think they can achieve it and have to a large extent in the eyes of the general public and in certain segments of the Protestant and evangelical worlds. However, there is a sizable segment of the evangelical world through the activities of various ministries and various websites and materials are aware of the unique and problematic history and teachings in the Mormon Church. So I think they're going to have problems when it comes to gaining respectability in Protestant circles and some segments in Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism. But I think by and large, the Mormon Church has been very successful and will continue to be so in presenting itself as yet just another family-oriented conservative Christian denomination.
Now, with one last question here, when the jury is in on this and everyone has been put where they belong, will this represent a enduring black mark on Mormonism in America? What do you think?
Well, we'll have to, again, we're going to have to wait and see what comes out. It may be that they decide not to because of the age of the victim. They decide not to release a whole lot of details. In some of my conversations with authorities, there was the possibility that there would be something of a gag order and not much would be released in order to protect her because she is a minor. It may be that we never know. It may be that some information is released and this general Mormon influence might have been a factor or it might not. All we have at this point is a concern and many questions that need to be answered. And I think the best we can do at this point is say the jury is out, literally and figuratively, and just wait and see where the evidence leads us down the line.
And what about Mormon fundamentalism, those groups, those families, those individuals out there that are still pursuing polygamous lifestyles without the strange aberrations of Brian Mitchell's religion. Does that remain an enduring problem for the LDS Church?
I think that does. It represents a public relations problem for the LDS Church. Interestingly, many of these polygamous families throughout the United States, and there are thousands of them, they have gained something of a measure of credibility themselves. They have various legislators who are saying, look, we have other crimes to prosecute and track and follow other than polygamy. These people are living in voluntary situations, it seems to be working for them. So I think the issue of polygamy in the United States will continue to be a social issue that generates a lot of controversy and will cause continued problems for the LDS Church.
John Moorhead, thank you for your time and for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
John Moorhead is Associate Director of the California Office of Watchman Fellowship. You can check out the website for that California office at watchman.org/CA. It's the California Office of Watchman Fellowship, watchman.org/CA. He's also author of an article in a recent edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Slim Link Between Mormonism and Notorious Kidnapping. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, it's open lines. Now, as usual, open lines is for anything you want to talk about, but something's on my mind, especially after yesterday's Rams game. This is on my mind, and I'll share with you a column by Bill McClellan titled From Hellish Season to the Bench, What Happened to Warner to Kick This Off? The question I want your answer to, does God care who starts as quarterback for the St. Louis Rams come Sunday against the Seattle Seahawks? There's a devout Mormon who played a very decent game, a devout Roman Catholic, I'm sorry, who played a very decent game yesterday, Mr. Bulger. Kurt Warner, a devout Christian as well. Season doesn't seem to be shaping up so well. Does God care who starts for the St. Louis Rams in Sunday's game? If he does, how will he make his decision? That's the question for you to answer when we come back with open lines for the third hour of Issues Etc. Those call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This break is a great time to call to get in early on the conversation for open lines, Issues Etc. Does God care who starts for the Rams in the quarterback position on Sunday? And if he does, how is he going to make his decision? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll start out with Bill McClellan's column when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.